This episode is brought to you in collaboration with Rhino Parade. Be tough, be vibrant, and celebrate the wild style of it all. That's what paper good and gift company Rhino Parade is all about. Shop now for protest goodies at rhinoparade.nyc. Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Welcome back, everyone. My name is Renee Powers, and I'm the founder of Feminist Book Club. I am so honored to bring you today's episode. It is a huge milestone. This is our 100th episode of Feminist Book Club, and I couldn't be prouder of this little piece of the internet that we've created together. Our guest today is none other than Morgan Jerkins, who's been the central figure of like all of my bookish fangirling since I first read her book in 2018, her first book. For those of you keeping track at home, her book, This Will Be My Undoing, was my favorite book of 2018, and I eagerly awaited and then devoured her most recent book, Wandering in Strange Lands, which we'll be talking about today. But before we get to that, our podcast editor, Phelan, asked me how I was going to be celebrating the 100th episode, and honestly, I hadn't even thought a little bit about it. But I let her nudge me in the direction of celebration, because you know what? It's 2020, and we need these little wins. Plus, as I've grown the Feminist Book Club team, I've written a manifesto for our company culture, and it includes this line. Employees are expected to ask questions, to take risks, and to celebrate and find joy in even the smallest wins. So, here's what we're gonna do. I didn't want to do this by myself, so I'm actually live on Instagram right now as I record this. If you're listening to this after it is published and you didn't join us on Instagram, don't worry. I'm probably gonna try to figure out how to save this video. So go over to our Instagram and watch the video so you can see this recording and maybe crack open a beverage with me. Our account is Feminist Book Club Box. So what's gonna happen, I am going to pop a mini bottle of bubbles in celebration. This is excellent audio. I had to open it first. All right. That was so anticlimactic. It's a twist off. Oh, well. I had to dust off the champagne flutes, which were freebies from college. So I live the classy life here. So thank you all for celebrating with me today. Well, that was hilarious. I do hope you'll go over and watch the video of my surprise and delight that that didn't have a pop cork. It was a twist off. It looks like a pop cork. I'm very disappointed. Didn't go as I expected, but you know what? That is what I've learned from entrepreneurism is nothing ever goes as expected and you just gotta go with it. So I want to tell you before we get into today's interview, I have to tell you about our sponsor today, which is Rhino Parade, such a fun paper goods and gift company based in Brooklyn, woman owned as always. And we are featuring one of their iron-on patches that looks like one of those sticky name tags. And it says, hello, I'm, and then in script, the patriarchy's worst nightmare. And it feels perfect for right now. We have to carry the torch from RBG. And so I hope that everyone puts this patch on their like most used jacket. So that will be in our October boxes. Our October boxes, we still have plenty. We ramped up all of our inventory in order to meet the demand. I hated selling out. So if you are interested, make sure you join us. Use code podcast for $5 off and you will get this Rhino Parade patch. You'll get a book tote from Writer's Atelier and Pretty Peacock Papery. You'll get a pack of book tabs from Girl of All Work. You'll get a bonus Lara bar because bonus. You'll get an exclusive deal from Minneapolis Craft Market's digital marketplace. You will also get the book of the month, which is The Year of the Witching by Alexis Henderson. And Alexis will be joining us for our discussion. So I don't understand why you're not signing up for this already. Stop what you're doing. Go sign up. I haven't drank in like 6 months, basically, like maybe a drink here or there. And so, you know, half a glass of champagne and I'm loose as a goose. Happy 100 episodes. But I do want to tell you about Rhino Parade. It was founded in 2016 by Lisa Mohar. She's a brilliant illustrator, artist. Just her designs are so inspiring. They've got tons of color, tons of quirkiness, tons of personality. And they're truly meant to celebrate, encourage, and support others. So not only are you supporting a woman-owned business, but there are specific products on rhinoparade.nyc, which is their website, that benefits specific organizations. So for instance, they have a Maxine Waters pin that benefits the National Congress of Black Women. They've got a pantsuits pin that benefits the Southern Poverty Law Center, protest postcards that benefit the ACLU, Stop Catcalling Right Meow pin and patch. Benefits of that go to Hollaback. So if you're looking for a way to do good with your money, beyond obviously the Feminist Book Club box, support Lisa and Rhino Parade in her incredible, fun, feisty designs. Rhinoparade.nyc is the website, and we will leave a link to that in our show notes as well. And you will be getting one of her iron-on patches in your October box. So without further ado, I am so honored, delighted, overjoyed, and humbled to bring you this conversation with Morgan Jerkins. I couldn't be more excited to say that sentence. So enjoy. And thank you, thank you, thank you for 100 episodes of Feminist Book Club. Here's to 100 more. Hi, everyone. I am so excited. Today, I am talking with Morgan Jerkins. Morgan is the author of the New York Times bestseller, This Will Be My Undoing, and her brand new book, Wandering in Strange Lands, A Daughter of the Great Migration Reclaims Her Roots. A visiting professor at Columbia University and senior editor at Zora, Jerkins' short form work has been featured in The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Atlantic, Rolling Stone, Elle, Esquire, and The Guardian, among so many others. She is based in Harlem, and we are talking today about her brand new book, Wandering in Strange Lands. Welcome, Morgan.
Hi.
Okay, I have to share that I'm a little starstruck because This Will Be My Undoing, your first book, is actually my favorite book of 2018, and I hand-sold it to so many people.
Thank you.
So, thank you. This, as luck would have it, this is actually our 100th episode, and I am just honored that you decided to join us and we could make this happen for episode number 100.
Yes, I'm excited. I'm even more excited now.
Oh, great. Okay, so we start with the same question. What does it mean to you to be feminist?
Oh, what does it mean for me to be feminist? It means for me to be able to have the same respect and have the same rights as a man, to be able to make my own choices and to make sure that I can help to assure that other women, irrespective of race, socioeconomic class, sexuality, able-bodied or disabled, can have the same opportunities as myself and be able to make those choices to live free, abundant, and of course, pleasurable lives.
Free, abundant, and pleasurable. That is beautiful. I love the way you put that.
Thank you.
Tell us about Wandering in Strange Lands.
Okay. Wandering in Strange Lands, well, it feels like many different iterations of it. I keep thinking about the first draft. Wandering in Strange Lands was predicated on a sense of loss. What I mean by loss is that I grew up in the North. I thought my life was just in the North. It was like a terminus point for me. And what I realized is that there was a chunk missing. Like, I knew that I had roots in the South, but I didn't know where. I didn't know why we ended up in the North. And when I spoke to other Black families, particularly other millennials who grew up in the North, there were always these different omissions. I don't know where my family is from the South, or I know where my family is from the South, but I've never been there. And what I found is that when I asked them about, you know, to give me an estimate of when they moved, it was around, you know, the early to mid 20th century, which, if you're not familiar with what I consider to be one of the greatest cultural shifts in American history, it's the Great Migration. From 1910 to 1970, millions of African Americans fled the South because of racial terrorism, and they went to all different parts of the United States. My family was a part of that exodus. And so What I did was I did a reverse migratory route, if you will. And I went back to the South, crossed the Midwest of the West in order to bridge the gap between those who fled their ancestral lands and those who stayed. And in tandem with doing that and learning about African, Black American identities, not identity, and land displacement and systemic violence and terrorism and cultural erasure, I also was able to trace 300 years of my own family history. So Wandering in Strange Lands is a hybrid account that is part memoir, part reportage, part ethnography, a part historical research, but totally an adventure.
Mm. It feels like, it reads like an adventure too. It was one of those that I couldn't wait to see where you were going next. And I'm curious about the method of it. You mentioned ethnography, memoir, reportage, which is a new word for me. Can you define that?
Oh, it's just reporting.
Oh, okay.
That's all.
So about the method of the book, why did you choose to go these different routes? And what is it about the topic that lends itself to a kind of autoethnographic memoir?
Well, okay. So I will be honest with you and say that when I started to write Wandering Strange Lands, I didn't think it was going to be a migratory story. Initially, I wanted to write about the intergenerational fear and trauma amongst African Americans. And I got that because of I was inspired by the movie Get Out. And there's a climactic scene in the book, and excuse me, in the movie where, you know, the Black male character's hand has his he has his hand wrapped around a white female character's throat, and a police car pulls up. And I'm sitting in Magic Johnson Theater in Harlem, and all of the people in there gasp. And I thought that it was astounding because I thought to myself, you know, not all of us may be native Harlemites. I'm sure as heck am not. And we both had this collective reaction. So that was what I thought the book was going to be about. And then when I spoke to two scholars about that, they said, oh, I think this is actually a migratory story. And so I did all of the research. You know, I knew I had to go down to the South. I knew I had to travel the country pretty much. But I didn't want to have the autoethnography in there. I didn't want, in fact, I think I sort of posited myself as a distant observer in the beginning because, you know, I am an extreme personal essayist. That's how I started my career. In fact, writing personal essays is one of the only ways for young women of color to gain a foothold in the industry. And, you know, I was worried that if I, you know, combine the personal with the reported parts, that I would be taken less seriously. And so that was what I was worried about. But then I thought about, you know, my literary ancestors, like, for example, Zora Neale Hurston, who, you know, pushed back against that when she was studying anthropology at Columbia University, that you don't have to be some scientific cold observer. You don't have to be quote unquote objective when you realize, especially, that you have a stake in the communities that you're writing about. And I did because I'm an African-American. So that's like how the book really started to expand.
I actually wrote down a quote about this for the audience at home who might be reading along with this. Page 183, you discuss a different kind of truth. That's the phrase that you use, where you realize that instead of relying on documents and textbooks, that we can really dig into our own stories and lore. And I believe this is in reference to Black indigeneity. Yes. And, you know, your family has this lore of possibly Cherokee ties, and that's not unusual, especially for Black and African American families. Can you talk a little bit more about what you mean by a different kind of truth?
Okay. So when I was growing up, everybody, and when I mean everybody, I mean every Black family I knew always claimed they had Indian in them. And every time you asked them, well, which type, they would always say Cherokee. And I used to get on my nerves. I'm like, well, how do you know that? And how do we know that? You know what I'm saying? And it was just very annoying because I didn't know any other way to verify that. And as I grew older, I realized that, you know, I started to hear from other Black people that claiming indigeneity is actually a form of anti-Blackness, because there is this idea that Black people were claiming indigeneity instead of, for example, whiteness because of trauma from slavery, like being raped from slave masters. But when I started to do some more research, I realized that a few things. You know, I'm a product of the public school system. And when I was taught about the Trail of Tears, which happened with, you know, the forced removal, when President Andrew Jackson forced five tribes, the Cherokee, the Choctaw, the Chickasaw, the Creek, and the Seminole, west of the Mississippi into Indian Territory, now known as Oklahoma, I didn't know, no textbooks that I read when I was a child said that Black people accompanied these tribes on the trip, whether as fugitives, free Black people, and enslaved by the tribes. And in fact, it was the Cherokee tribe that was the largest holder of enslaved Black people out of those five tribes. And they also, the Cherokee tribe, they came from the South. So I said to myself, if it is the case that these indigenous tribes' migratory paths overlap with Black people's migratory paths, could there have been any relation? Could there have been overlap? And so it definitely pointed me to a different kind of truth because I wasn't taught this. I mean, I've spoken to people even after my book was released. They live in Oklahoma and they were not taught this. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean, like a different kind of truth. And that's why I really try to make sure I pluralize when I say Black American identities and Black American histories, because there's so many and they're often not talked about. They're devalued or, you know, they're just erased altogether.
Yeah, that's what I thought was so fascinating about this book, especially because not only do you go to Oklahoma and Florida to look into possible Cherokee roots, you also travel to Louisiana to explore your Creole heritage and the mm-hmm. Lowcountry in Georgia and South Carolina and talk to the Gullah Geechee people. And there are so many facets of your identity that speaks to so much Black American history that I guess what I'm getting at is I think Americans, all Americans are interested, and that's a generalization, I recognize that, but we're all interested in genealogy and we're interested in other people's genealogy as well. And so I'm wondering what your research has illuminated in terms of your own genealogy and just genealogy more generally. Why do you think we're so fascinated with it?
I mean, well, I will just say it's because it's such a winding road, you know, it's like you have to really be a sleuth. And I think what is fascinating and heartbreaking at the same time when you're an African-American trying to do genealogy is that there are so many hurdles to go through. Archives and other type of historical documents aren't always safely kept. A lot of our ancestors, particularly those that were enslaved, they were illiterate. Reading and writing was a death sentence at one time. So all that was passed down wasn't written. And a lot of times the narratives of our lives have been, you know, in the hands of white people in their institutions. So it creates all these sort of uphill battles, especially when we talk about the collision course between oral histories and documentation. So it's fascinating, you know, when we get into genealogy, because it's like, where did I come from? And oftentimes when I was doing this research, I had to ask also, like, what did my people perhaps do to survive in order for me to exist in the first place? And that is exactly what's great about genealogy, just trying to go backwards. And the great thing about, you know, nowadays that you have the internet, where you can find some of these documents, you can find other people that have these family trees, like on Ancestry.com or on Archives. And, you know, it can be helpful, but and man, it is a lot. There were a lot of false starts. There was a lot of circuitous motion.
I'm glad you brought up, you know, DNA tests and Ancestry.com and these kinds of things, because one of my big takeaways of this book is that DNA tests cannot and will not and will never tell the full story of our ancestry. And DNA is not fact, right? And can you talk a little bit about why that's so?
Oh, man. The whole...
The big question.
You know, the idea of like, okay, so I'll give you an example, right? Like, going back to Blackness and indigeneity, a lot of times I would speak to Black people and they say, well, I was told this in my family, but the DNA said I don't have anything. So I'll speak about some of the women that I spoke of, that I documented in my book. For example, one woman, she is from Florida, and she said, I've always been told that I have Seminole in my family, but my DNA says I don't have anything. Well, I found out that the Seminoles occupied the county where her family's from. Same thing in Georgia. I met a woman, her name was Trudy Appling, and She said, if I'm not mistaken, I'm trying to remember, that, you know, she heard that she had Creek in her family line, but DNA told her that she didn't have it. Well, when I looked up Appling County, it was originally occupied, or something, you know, the Creek settled there. And so, take it a step further. I interviewed a woman who was Cherokee and Creek ancestry. Her parents were Cherokee and Creek freedmen. And when she took a DNA test, just for fun, she took a DNA test and it said that she's 13% Native American. And then when she took it, and then she got an update like a couple weeks or months later, and it said, oh, now you're 25%. Well, how is that true if both of her parents have Black and Indigenous blood? So I think that, you know, it's really important to, like, to tell people that, you know, that DNA it's not the end all be all. Blood is not the end all be all, especially with Indigenous people. Like it's about kinship. It's about those sorts of things as well. And also, I feel like I'm going into a circle here, but with regards to indigeneity and doing DNA testing, right? Native Americans don't give a lot of their blood to these corporations, and for good reason, right? Think about the amount of devastation and just annihilation that has been brought to a lot of their communities. So they're working with a small sample base. So how can it be accurate?
Yeah, that was the part that just bowled me over, was, of course, especially people of Native American descent don't want to give their blood to corporations. Of course they don't. Therefore, how can we be sure that any of this is accurate?
Right. And, you know, take it a step further, I'm going to say something, and I know this is going to be like a bombshell, so, you know, cut me off if you want. But it reminds me of, like, remember, and I wrote about it in the book, when Elizabeth Warren, you know, claimed that she was Native American, and people got on her for that. You know, she took a DNA test where, you know, DNA tests cannot be the end all be all, but she's also from Oklahoma, right? Which originally, you know, it was Indian territory. And, you know, the Cherokee Nation, for example, like they put out a statement about it, and it's true. You know what I'm saying? Like, what about, you know, she had no membership to the tribe. She wasn't a citizen of Cherokee Nation. But then I thought about it and I said, well, I know the woman. Her name is Marilyn Van. She's the president of the Descendants of Freedmen Association. And it was because of her efforts that Cherokee freedmen had to be accepted by Cherokee Nation as full citizens of the tribe. And that was just in 2017.
Wow.
So that's why I was like, okay, I know this is an offhand comment about it, but it was like, what about the Black people from other parts of the five civilized tribes that aren't recognized as full citizens because of the fact that they have Black ancestry? What about that? You know? So that's just something that I was thinking about as that whole controversy was going on.
Yeah. It begs the question, how did you decide what to include in this book? I mean, I was not expecting freedmen, Cherokee freedmen in this at all. You know, I wasn't surprised by Louisiana and the Low Country, but I'm sure there was so much, right? That this required so much overwhelming research. How did you decide what to include in the final product?
Well, I mean, there was a lot of revision. And there were certain things I was like, I wish I had some outtakes, you know, where I could just include this, you know? Because remember, when I went to Oklahoma, for example, I talked to people of all the five civilized tribes. But what I had to focus on was Cherokee, because it aligns with my family history, and also with, it was the most common tribe mentioned by other Black families that I knew. So that's why I had to edit there. But also, it's like, I was trying to figure out a way to structure it from going from the personal and then expanding, going from these places where I thought, you know, it's a mystery or there's these gaps, and then pulling it back to show that it has broader implications.
I want to touch on something that you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation. You said something along the lines of personal essays for women of color, especially, is a way to gain entry into the publishing industry. And this book is also personal, but personal, like deeply personal in a different way. And I'm wondering if you feel the same way about this one as you did This Will Be My Undoing. I want to know, it's twofold, I suppose.
Yeah, oh, okay.
From what I understand, it's kind of like trauma porn, right? That a lot of times we're curious to read people's really deeply personal and vulnerable experiences. And women of color especially feel that that's
the only way they can get a foothold into the publishing industry.
Right. Well, okay.
And at the same time, this is kind of a step further into that in a more deeply personal, like individual, I suppose, story about you. And so is that the same route, or do you think that you're going down a different road with it?
I tried to explain this to other people, but it's like, yeah, back in 2014, when I started writing, you weren't getting a foothold in the industry if you were, for example, wanted to do investigative reporting, if you wanted to do travel features. It was more personal essays and confessional writing. And I agree with you. Like, usually when women wanted to write about themselves, they chose the most salacious details, because usually, you know, you would think that people don't want to hear about, you know, oh, I fell in love, la-di-da. It's like, no, this traumatic thing happened to me. So when we get into the issue of like trauma porn, I feel a type of way about that. And the reason why I feel that type of way, and maybe I can say it because I didn't just write personal essays. Like, I knew after about a year and a half into freelance writing that I had to write more. I had to write features and interviews. I was able to build up my portfolio to expand. But I'll say this, like, when I do the work that I do, when I write personal essays, I usually go from a place of shame and work my way out. And so a lot of times, like, when I would write essays, I felt like I had to inform people. And people might say, well, why do you feel like you have to inform people, like white people? And it's like, because a lot of them don't understand. They don't know. And we have been subjected to their subjectivities since we've been educated in American school system. Why can't they read about mine? And then the question will, you know, that begs the question, well, do you think that all your job is to educate white people? No, I don't. Because I also write to show that other Black women are not alone. And to this day, I still get messages, emails, Instagram DMs from Black women that tell me that, you know, I thank you for writing this because this is exactly what I needed. It felt like someone read my childhood. And that's invigorating for me to read and to know that you're not alone. You know what I'm saying? So it's twofold. I will say with writing, you know, This Will Be My Undoing versus Wandering in Strange Lands, I was in a different place. When I wrote This Will Be My Undoing, I was 24. The book was published when I was 25. You know, now, Wandering in Strange Lands is coming out now that I'm, you know, I'm 28 years old. Granted, that's only, well, my first book came out in 2018, so that was 2 years ago. I know that's only 2 years, but it's like, if any of you are astro lovers, like, that's, I'm in the middle of my Saturn return.
Yeah.
Life is different for me now in many different ways. I feel much healthier. I feel much grounder in who I am, even though who I am is changing a lot. And, you know, I have more self-care practices in place also because I'm making more money. So fortunately, that goes hand in hand. But I'm in a different spot. And I think that my writing reflects that. And it's also, when I think of myself in this different spot, it's not only just psychologically, but interest-wise. I don't have a lot of interest writing strictly personal essays right now. And the reason why I don't is because I already told so much about myself in my first book. Now I'm just like, I want to experience things and just experience them. Or if I'm going to write about those experiences, I want to tie in research. I'm a huge history buff now. And that's what I like to do. I don't want it to be 100% just me. What is the historical precedent for this? That's what I always like to ask myself for any interest that I have.
Oh, so interesting. And there's so much history in this book and so many things that I had no idea about. And so I'm so grateful that you're interested in them so you can share them with the rest of us.
Thank you.
And it's so personal and you lay so much bare, and you mentioned that you have better self-care practices now 2 years after This Will Be My Undoing. And so I'm curious about those self-care practices. How do you juggle this, you know, intense research-laden writing life with taking care of Morgan?
I mean, I'll be honest with you, like, that's something I'm still thinking about, because I'm working on my fourth, you know, I'm working on a fourth book idea, you know what I'm saying? And some of the research that I'm getting into is devastating. And I have to have boundaries for myself. So for example, when I was writing Wandering Strange Lands, I remember one night I was reading about infant slave mortalities on rice plantations. And I was like, oh no, I'm not reading this right now. The sun is down. I'm going to read this tomorrow. So I tell myself after a certain hour, you're not reading about this. Because you're not going to let that sit in your stomach because it's not going to be able to digest before you get to bed. So those are certain self-care practices that I have. Because my book has come out in the pandemic, I'm definitely being mindful of rest.
Yeah.
I am like the Energizer Bunny. I like to do things fast. I'm very, you know, I'm very quick. And I had to remind myself, like, you really got to take care of your body. You know, because I was always so used to these mini burnouts, I like to call them, these burnouts that I have. Well, you know, after 2 days of long naps, I can get rid of them. But no, I was like, no, you need to change this. So I think that is being more mindful of rest, being more mindful. Hey, I need to reschedule something. And it may just because I just need more rest and that's it. You know what I'm saying? I think another part of self-care routine for me is outsourcing the work. Understand that it takes a village. You know, people say it takes a village to raise a child. It takes a village to help an adult. Mm-hmm. It takes a village to create a book. So I always try to make sure to, if I need help with something, to just ask someone. I feel like even though I'm not a freelancer full-time anymore, I still in the back of my mind, I'm in freelancer mode. And I feel like I have to do everything myself. And I realize I'm not there anymore. That's not my space. So it's almost like I have to shed another skin. Pre-pandemic, I would do a lot of different things for self-care. Of course, well, I still work out in my apartment, but I would definitely go to the gym. I would get my nails done every other Friday, Friday evening. I would get massages once a month. Sometimes I get a facial like every 2 months or something like that. Things like that just make me feel good. Or I'll go online and if I see a nice dress that I know that's going to look good in my size, I'm going to buy it. You know, and I think those are some things I couldn't do before. Because I wasn't making enough money and I wasn't loving myself as best as I could. Oh, and also I go to therapy regularly. And that's because of great health insurance because of my job.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you are making these caveats too, that we can't all afford to have our nails done and go to therapy right. And all of these things.
Right.
But it doesn't cost anything to, you know, run up a flight of stairs or work out at home as long as you have the space and the safety and the time to do it.
Right. And I always try to preface it because, you know, people ask me or people used to ask me, like, how do I become a writer in New York? And I always have to preface, like, you can look at my story, but my story is from a place of significant economic privilege. And I never want to downplay that. Like, I graduated from college with no student loans. I didn't have any student loans for my MFA program because my late stepfather was a veteran and I got VA benefits because of that, a stipend to do grad school. So I'd never want to downplay that because had I not gotten those opportunities, I would be over 200 grand in debt and I'd probably just now making my way into New York from Jersey or still there. I don't know. But I would not have been able to come to New York as quickly as I did. When I was building up my portfolio from out of my first year out from college, I was living at home rent free. So I had the time and space to do that. So that's why I always try to preface, you know, those sorts of things. But yeah, with regards to self-care, like I'm able to love up on myself or just treat myself with things that I've only dreamed of doing before because I'm making more money. And it's a shame that we live in a society where, you know, sometimes certain things we want to do is predicated on this sort of dog-eat-dog, ultra-capitalistic way of thinking.
Yeah, it sucks that, you know, the way to take care of yourself in the best way possible and the most fulfilling way possible often costs money.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go back to, you know, how did I make it as a writer in New York? And for somebody who wants to follow the same path and may also have some of those barriers taken down from them, what are some of the things that you wish that you knew about the publishing industry, about digital media before you ventured into them?
I wish I would have just got more encouragement. I wish I just would have learned that just because you don't have a staff writing position somewhere does not mean that you're not talented, does not mean that you're not valuable. I think that's one of the things that was very painful for me for like the first 3 years of me writing was that I really just thought I was a failure because I did not have a staff job somewhere, despite the fact that I had been writing so prolifically. I mean, this today, I literally counted how many articles I'd written from 2014 to now, and it's over 120.
Wow.
And for half of that time, I thought to myself that I was not talented because I wasn't getting a staff job, when really digital media is extremely volatile. There's a lot of turnover rates. There's a lot of layoffs. And some of the people that I idolized before, they're not working in the same capacity anymore. So I wish that I would have got some encouragement. I just continue to do what you do. Don't worry about it. Like, do a job, a staff job, it cannot validate talent.
Ooh, that's good. Okay, we are winding down and I could talk to you for hours. Did I hear somewhere that you're working on a novel?
I am. So I actually have a third book coming out next year. It's my debut novel.
Can you tell
us
about it? It's
called Call Baby. Yes, Call Baby. So in African-American folklore, there is a belief that if a child is born inside the call, born with a veil, as we say, that they have these special abilities, healing properties, second sight, being able to see into the future or see into the past. And so basically Call Baby is about that. It's about two families who are ensnared in the nexus between Black motherhood and capitalism within a gentrifying neighborhood that is Harlem, and a baby with a gift that is the call that tests their loyalties. So that's what's Call Baby out there. That's my elevator pitch.
Oh my goodness. Can we pre-order it yet?
Oh, not yet.
Okay.
I'll get pre-ordered information. It'll happen around mid-October. But yeah, it's coming out April 2021.
Oh my goodness. April is my birthday month. So thank you for that gift.
Hey.
I cannot wait to get my hands on that. Thank you.
Did
so
I do a good
much.
Job with the elevator pitch? That's the first time I think somebody asked me that on air.
So good. It's so good. How has writing fiction differed from writing personal essays and nonfiction?
I don't know if not many people notice about me, but fiction was my first love. I wrote as a therapeutic vent in high school and because I was being bullied and harassed all the time. And that was fiction. When I went to Bennington, I mean, I studied under Angie Cruz and Alexander Chi, among others, and it was fiction. In fact, the first iteration of Call Baby, the first 100 pages, is my thesis and is sitting in the Crossett Library at Bennington College right now. So fiction is actually my first love. And so that's why I'm excited and, of course, nervous about, you know, the type of, you know, the reactions that it will get when it comes out. But I think fiction and nonfiction go hand in hand with each other. It was through nonfiction I was able to find my voice and to fill that voice with a pulse, with urgency. Because when you write online, especially nonfiction, you have to write in that way. And fiction, you know, especially being at Bennington, I learned about craft. I learned about structure. In an investigative type of way, I think if I do say so myself, of learning about characters and their motivations and the emotional gravitas of scenes, which I think that I've tried to incorporate in Wandering Strange Lands a lot, which introducing all these people and letting them speak and talk about not only the grander aspects of travel and all that, but also the minutia of it. So they definitely, I think there's a synergy between the two, at least in my body of work.
I can see in your first two books how it is influenced by your skills in fiction writing. And so that makes me really excited to read your fiction. I can't wait. So we have come to the end. Morgan, I am so honored and thrilled to have had you on the show. We ask the same two questions at the end. And the first is, do you have a book to recommend that is not your own that you think our audience should check out?
Yes, I would like to recommend Girl, Woman, Other by Bernardine Evaristo. She's the first Black woman to win the Booker Prize alongside Margaret Atwood.
Which we don't talk about.
Oh, what's that?
We don't talk about that. She should have won it outright.
Oh, no, I know. Oh, no, I know. But I was also going to recommend Culture Warlords by Talia Levin. It's coming out in October this year.
Oh, interesting. I haven't heard of that one. I will look it up. I will leave that in the show notes along with links to your work. Wandering in Strange Lands is brilliant. And if anybody is interested in the Great Migration and genealogy and Black history, you have to pick this up. And then the last question is, where can we find you online if we want to learn more about what you're doing next?
You could find me on Twitter at Morgan Jerkins. You can also find me on Instagram _Morgan Jerkins.
Excellent. Thank you so, so much. This has been wonderful.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.